Welcome back, guys. DGS. I'm KMOX. You can listen on 98.7 FM right there in your car radio. You can listen to the Odyssey app. You can download our podcast, as millions of people do every single year. People we keep asking about our podcast. Here's what's going on. I'm going to have to kind of crap on my company. We've been ready. The company's been going through a lot of stuff, and they're trying to do it right with us because it's going to be a nationally pushed podcast, not just locally, trying to compete with all the big guys. And so we're building out, studios and lighting and cameras and things like that. And it doesn't happen overnight, but we're hoping to have the first of those products out in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So thanks for being patient and for supporting that. That's great. Shout out to Ms. Joanne Garner, who is one of my sound stories that I did today. She was born in 1935, so she would be 91, right? 89, somewhere around there.
87, I think.
And she grew up one town over during the same period of time from my mom and dad.
Oh.
So that was cool. I remember going to Cesar, Illinois, for going to like a VFW or something like that, American Legion for fish fries, and that's where she grew up. And just when you, it's such a true honor when people choose you to do this, because we're recording an hour about her life, and that will be for posterity. That'll be for her kids and grandkids and great grandkids. And it really is such an amazing thing, a privilege, when they choose you to do that. But I have to tell you, it has a real effect on me, because her life was so wonderful and it was so normal, and her parents were so normal, and her parents were so loving and instilled all the best in her. And then she was the oldest of six who she helped raise. Then she instilled all the best in her kids, and her kids are great. And it's not like her life was without any sort of sadness or, that she was a perfect person, but pretty damn close. I mean, you look back, and that's what was some of your biggest regrets. And she's like, well, I only have one. And I'm like, here we go. Here we go. Let's hear it, Joanne.
Give us the dirt.
She was like, when I was young, I wasn't as nice to one of my sisters as I should have been. I should have let her play with me more. And I'm like, and then you killed her? Like, like what? And just an exemplary life.
That's cool.
And not to crap on my own childhood or my own parents, but I grew up in a way that 1 + 1 didn't equal 2 and 2 + 2 didn't equal 4. And so when I got out into the world, I didn't have this set of things that made sense. And so I tended to kind of go like, hey, why don't I do this? Why don't I jump on that? Why don't I just leap off of this? Why don't I try to? And then you learn slowly, if you're me, like, well, that didn't work, and that didn't work, and that wasn't so good. So, yeah, I hope I did a better job. You know, that my kids will have a little more of a framework. I'm sure I didn't do it perfectly, but when you hear someone's life story in the space of an hour, it really, really hits you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it hits you how important that is, to lay that foundation as a parent, because it's been going for 3 generations with them.
Yep. I mean, that's the, nobody's background, nobody's upbringing is the same, I mean, because your parents come from different places. In fact, your two parents each come from completely different places, and then they come together. And that's why, I think most people's goal is just, even if you had a good childhood, you always want to see if you can do better for your kid. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And having great parents is no guarantee that you're going to be a good person.
No, not at all.
And vice versa.
That's right.
A lot of people come from very dysfunctional homes and end up pushing against that.
Yep.
And becoming very special people.
Yep.
We haven't talked about Israel and Gaza and Hamas in a very long time. Let's talk about that a bit. Who knows the most about what happened with Chef Andreas?
Well, it was part of it's a nonprofit that has been working there in relief,
yes,
right? And I forget the name of it. It's something
Central Food.
Central Food, right. And essentially, there were a bunch of aid workers in a vehicle, and it got bombed. It got blown up. And Israel is saying, we did it. It was our mistake. Terrible mistake. Tragic incident is what I think what Netanyahu called it. And I've been reading a little bit about, the reaction to it, right? I saw a couple of guys that are what would he call it? military analysts, former, former agency type people, not the CIA, but just people that were in agency saying, I mean, there's the thing you have to do here is anybody that was involved has to be essentially, not necessarily legally, but essentially put on trial, right? You're pulled out of duty. We're going to figure out why this went wrong. And you have to, you know, obviously apologize. But I mean, like, what else is there to do? You know, I mean, whoever did it screwed up bad. And people that are there to help that are not combatants get killed.
I think the larger story, this is a very tragic thing that's happened. I don't know Chef Andreas before. We've had him on the show, but I don't know him.
Right.
Like we know some of the other guests. But just a saint of a guy and does so much for so many people. And this really highlights it. His quote was, Israel needs to stop, quote unquote, indiscriminately killing. And as I understand it, here's sort of my normal guy take on it. And I said this right after October 7th, that I hope that this is, I hope it's not Lucy in the football. I hope that whatever the response is, and after October 7th, when you had all these horrific things happening and, you know, hundreds of people killed and people raped and babies and the whole bit. And I think everyone was behind Israel at the time. And then we had months of what to me looked no different than what was happening in Russia and Ukraine. Just a whole lot of residential buildings being razed to the ground. And again, just through my own eyes. And then Israel saying, well, look, Hamas is hiding amongst the people. This is the only way to do it. I know that we've done things like that when we were prosecuting our war in the Middle East. But that wasn't televised in real time. And so something like 8,000 Hamas fighters killed, something like 30,000 civilians killed, something like 10 to 15,000 children. And to me, at some point you have to say, this is not okay. It doesn't matter whether it's Israel or the United States, that when you have this very small piece of land with a relatively small group of people and an even smaller group of bad guys, as a non-military people, I don't think it's okay to kill 30,000 to get 8, although we've done it. And maybe that's absolutely the way it's done. But do you feel me?
Yeah.
But absolutely. I don't think that makes you anti-Semitic.
No, it doesn't.
I don't think that makes you anti-Israel. I think that no matter who it, because if it was the United States doing it to Canada or Mexico, I would be saying, hey, is there another way maybe that we could get the hostages or bring out some of our ninjas or our special ops to get these bad guys that we're going after? And the answer to me might be no. That's a wonderful idea, Dave, but that's not a thing. That's not the way it works. But I am troubled by the fact that it seems that we have chosen sides so stringently that you can't say, I support Israel. What happened to them on October 7th was terrible. I wish there wasn't a single Hamas fighter still alive, but we need to stop killing tens of thousands of civilians.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the same thing that the chef said, which is that this is indicative of what we've seen from Israel for months now, which is indiscriminate bombing of the Gaza Strip.
And I'm far more
blowing up trucks.
I'm far more concerned with the history of Israel. The future of Israel than I am the future of Hamas. And I just don't know that this is great for the future of Israel.
Well, you can also speak out against innocent Palestinians being killed without being pro-Hamas. These are all narratives that whoever is spinning, and it's backing people into corners. Like, if you question anything, then you're pro-Hamas, you're anti-Semitic, and it's just simply not fair. You should be able to say, I don't think 32,000 Palestinians should be dead right now. That's not a political statement. That's saying, I don't want innocent people to keep dying. I don't want babies to keep starving. I mean, if you watch the news I watch PBS News Hour every night. They cover this war extensively. The things you're seeing out of Gaza are inhumane. It doesn't make you against anyone to say, I want this to stop happening. And it's just ridiculous that we've gotten to this point where you have to choose your words so carefully, or else you'll be labeled as like against Israel.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
I agree with everything you guys are saying. Because at first you have to do something.
Yes.
You can't just say, oh, well, October 7th
we
happened.
These actions.
But you have to do things,
that's
right?
That's what I'm saying.
Right. But at some point you also have to regain control and be a little more precise in what you're doing. I think we all can agree on a simple thing like that. But the people who conducted the Iraq War are still around, most of them. I mean, I've seen estimates anywhere from 150 to 250,000 civilian deaths in the Iraq war. Way more than anything that's happening now. And I think, Dave, the point you hit on is right. We didn't see it. Mm-hmm. It was before social media. It was before Twitter and every other, you know, every other outlet. So we didn't see all of those civilians being killed. We didn't see what was happening in those Iraqi cities when we went in. But it happened. And we don't want to talk about that. And I'm not saying they're necessarily related. I mean, they're only related in that if this is that bad, then what we did was worse. And the fact that we didn't see it doesn't change that. So we also then need to recognize and maybe, I don't know what.
Apologize?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but then if you do that, then are you asking to be prosecuted in the world court for war crimes? I mean, like, that's why all of this is so complicated to me, because we the fact that we know that happened but didn't see it shouldn't change how we treat it. And I'm fascinated by this overall, because when Russia does it, we are up in arms. But when we did it, nobody could say boo to us.
How does that tie into the Israel stuff, though? I agree with what you're saying fully. I'm not really connecting the two dots.
I'm saying that somehow, some way, as a people, as human beings, and as a country in the United States, we need to find some consistency with how we do things. We can't be critical of someone else doing what we did. I don't mean us, human, like individual. We can, because we didn't do those things. But I do think that we have to be more consistent in applying logic and reason, rather than just saying, well, we did it, so it's not that bad. But somebody else doing it is terrible and you got to stop. It's a very difficult line to walk.
What would you see us do? Sorry.
That's a great question. I don't know.
How about a couple of science things? Remember, I think it was last week when I said, it seems so dumb to me that we're so eager to abandon Earth. And Elon Musk says that we're going to have people on Mars in 5 years and all this stuff. We're going to terraform it. And I said, it just seems to me like if we found two planets and one was Mars and one was Earth, basically like it is now, we would be like, all our problems are solved. Look at this place we found, Earth. And Mars, like, oh, we're thousands of years from that even being habitable. And Martin Rees, who is one of the leading physicists and astrophysicists, just came out yesterday and said basically the same thing, said, it's so stupid. Like, yeah, eventually we'll probably go farther, you know, and we'll find places, and we'll live other places, but we're talking a very long time from now. And he called out Elon Musk and said he's going to get people killed because he has these crazy ideas and he thinks he can do anything and he cannot take people to Mars on any. Can we land someone on Mars? Yes. Can someone live there for a few months? Possibly. Is that our new home? No. And he said that the Earth is perfectly, perfectly fine. He believes in climate change. He believes that it is human caused, but the planet is fine, as we always say. It will survive this infection of humanity, or humanity will get their stuff together and we'll dial it back down, or we'll learn to live with bigger oceans and less land, whatever it is. But basically that the Earth is so vastly our best option that we would be better served investing in Earth than investing in going to Mars. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
I mean, it makes sense.
It's fun to go to Mars.
Yeah, it's a fun thought
it's
experiment.
It's exciting.
It well, would I mean, be fun can't... to visit there. But yeah, why would you want to go there and live out the rest of your life? It's not exactly friendly to humans.
Let's put it this way. Right. We would have to terraform Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can terraform Mars,
we can certainly
then
handle
we can
this.
Fix here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Exactly my point.
I mean, unless you're just building giant bubbles to live in on Mars, which again... If you can do that there, you can do
like
that
if
here.
If we found this planet we're on now and we said, well, it's a little warm, you know, a little too much CO2, but only by a couple percent. Oh, my God. What a godsend. The other thing is, and this is crazy, I didn't even know that we were doing this, but we have set a new record for how long we have kept an artificial sun going. We have created an artificial sun that is 100 million degrees It's plasma. And we have kept it going for 48 seconds. That is many, many times hotter than the middle of the sun.
Where was it? I don't care for that one bit.
Where was it?
At Hartford, Illinois.
How did it not burn stuff?
It was naturally occurring.
How many million degrees?
100.
The hell?
I know. It's crazy,
pretty,
huh?
It's pretty cool, but...
Do you know the size of it? Did they say?
I'm sure it was very, very small.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the article said...
Atomic level, yeah.
Yeah.
Dave's like, who cares?
Also, last night I ate a chip and it did that thing where it slipped down and cut my bottom gum. Okay. I'll say it, hero. I probably shouldn't even be here right now. I should probably be in some sort of hospital or rehab, but...
The worst is when it's a tortilla chip and it gets...
That's exactly what it was.
Did it get in between your teeth?
Ooh, that's a bad
one. It dwelled there for a moment.
Oh, yeah. No.
You ever had the one that gets into the top and it's stuck?
Yep.
Didn't just cut you. It's like if you open your mouth, it's just hanging there.
It's a part of you now.
Yeah.
Also, did you guys know that Planters has a nutmobile?
A what? That sounds...
I think
really
I
bad.
Didn't know
it looks
that.
Even worse.
That
Google
sounds,
it.
Really? All right.
And how are they not traveling with the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile?
Yeah, right? Seems like a no-brainer.
Right?
Very embarrassingly, when you were talking about the chip on the lower gum, I checked, and I did have a tortilla chip there from lunch.
Oh.
Just like hanging out in the lower gum.
Dave,
that was
I have a picture of the two of them next to each other.
Yeah.
The Wienermobile.
It's not ideal, is it?
No. You better just gotta put it this way. I'm trying to say this in the right way. I'm getting in trouble. You definitely need to park them in a correct way. Park them parallel to one another.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Not perpendicular.
Also, did you guys see the Adidas soccer thing, the way that they make their numbers? The number 44 looks like the SS logo.
Oh.
And people have been buying it like crazy for just that reason.
Oh, for God's sake.
So now Adidas is going to have to change the way they do their fours because so many thousands of people wanted the SS.
My Lord.
Yeah.
I believe they are either banning it. Nation, like worldwide, like they're just stopping selling it, or I think you might.
How do you let that out?
Germany has already banned it.
Germany's banned it, I know.
Yeah. Holy crap.
Yeah.
How does that get past testing?
Exactly. That has to go through so many
and
people.
And who buys it? Who's like, hey, that looks Nazi-ish?
Well, Nazis.
There's plenty of those, unfortunately.
Ask a stupid question. 2:35, going to be talking to our pal Rick Horton coming up in the next segment. Looking forward to that. I hate to just keep being heavy here on the show, but I'm looking at Drudge, the front page, all red, all capital letters, Iran revenge because Israel has hit Iran in addition to some chefs. Preparing strikes, warning, World War III fears soar, protests erupt across the Middle East. Am I ridiculously wrong and Pollyannish when I blame about 500 human beings for all this, regardless of the trouble in the world, whether it's Ukraine or Russia or I feel like the same way. Remember when the Kim Gardner stuff and everyone's trying to come up with ideas and we had some program. I forgot the name of it. It obviously failed. But the basics of the program were, look, all of St. Louis crime comes down to less than 50 people.
I think it was Cure Violence.
There you go.
Yeah.
And we need to find those 50 people and we need to deal with them. Mathematically, that makes sense. I think they failed because, hello, but mathematically, it makes sense. And if you tell me that all of this nastiness in St. Louis is caused by less than 100 people, I believe it. There's a number for that on the globe. And I'm not sure it's many more than that. I'm not sure that there are many more than, say, 500 people who really make the decisions and have the evil in their heart, like a Putin who's evidently worth $500 billion or something crazy like that, who just says, let's do some more evil stuff. You feel me? That if you could find those 500 people and if we had the balls to take them and deal with them, how much better the world would be. For example, we're not going to do it. We can't do it. The die's been cast. The world is the way it is. We have the UN. We have presidents. We have premiers. We have kings. We have queens. But if the aliens came down and watched us for about a year, they'd go, oh, these 500 people right here, get them. Bring them to the top of this mountain. We'll deal with them. Then everything's going to be better. Feel me?
Yeah.
I think part of the problem, though, is those people have convinced millions,
yes,
if not billions, depending on who they are, that
because they can't
their
do
cause
it alone.
Is correct.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's, personally, I think there's more than 500.
But
I think there's more than 500.
Second. Those people, I think, probably would not have gone bad other than those strong men convincing him that they should do something.
I mean, probably. I mean, history shows how small numbers of people can implement. Look at what we were just talking about, the Adidas SS jerseys.
Yeah.
Look at that example. How many of those people in pre-World War II Germany were that way and were going to take that action if not for the people that took power? And it wasn't a huge number of people that ran the Nazi Party.
Yeah.
It was
right.
A very small number that made those decisions.
The true believers.
And then obviously it grew from outside out of that.
Yes. Andrew, back to you. What are you saying?
I just think there's a lot more than 500, you know, corrupt politicians, corrupt cops worldwide, corrupt soldiers worldwide. I think that number is a lot higher than 500. And I also think that, you know, you were like the followers of a strong man aren't necessarily going to repent and rehabilitate if you remove the strong man.
Well, I'm not
it's
saying
just going to be
I'm not saying that there are 500
strong.
Bad people in the world.
Right.
I'm saying
the
on
leaders.
A global scale, when you're talking about World War III, there's nobody in Chesterfield that's affecting that.
Let's call them shot callers.
Yeah.
They're the shot callers.
Yeah.
But if you remove a shot caller, they just get replaced by one of their followers becomes the shot caller.
Most likely.
And so I'm just saying I think it's not 500. I think it's like 500,000.
Either way, it's a tiny percentage of the population, right? I mean, it's a very small number of people that are actually, for lack of a better term, pushing the buttons on making things happen.
Mm-hmm. And they're so much more active now.
Are they? I mean, I'm legit
I believe
question.
So.
Yeah.
Like when I was a young man, you knew those people were out there, but they seemed so very, very far away. And the chances of something actually happening seemed so very, very remote. And now it seems like when I was interviewing Joanne Garner today, who lived through, you know, World War II as a young child in Vietnam as a young mom and things like that, that her life seemed very normal. And then episodically seemed very scary.
Right.
And now it's the opposite. And maybe it's just me being too fragile. But the world seems very fragile and scary. And then you have moments of calm.
I don't think you're fragile. I think it's just so much more in your face. I don't know if it's necessarily more dangerous now. I mean, I wasn't around for these things that you've described, but I'm sure there were lots of things like on the edge and bad things could be happening, but you just didn't have it, you know, fed into your phone and onto your television screen. And the Drudge Report didn't exist back there. And it's bold red letters, like kind of freaking you out and scaring you. So I don't know.
You know, the World War II is an interesting comparison, like bringing that up, because I think it was 85 million people died during World War II. And at the time, there were only about 2.3 billion people on the planet. So now let's multiply that essentially by three just to stay low. So we'd be talking about 200 million people being killed in a war right now to have the equivalent, with wars going on all over Europe and in the Pacific. And we're not near that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not what's happening in the world right now. And yet, I don't know, maybe it's just the result of not having faced anything like that in a long time that this seems like it's building. But I keep seeing people that have done, you know, military and analyst work. They're like, these are not things that lead to world wars like what we're seeing now. They're not going to that level because of X, Y, and Z. I'm not smart enough to know what those things are, but everything is in your face more. I mean, we just did this conversation about, you know, what's going on in Gaza. It's what we're seeing it. If it was 50 years ago, we wouldn't be. We wouldn't have any idea. I mean, you'd hear it. But as we've seen with many other conflicts in history, if you're not seeing it, you're not really paying. It's not real.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel real, right? If you're not seeing it or feeling it.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. And when I talk about my beloved 80s and 90s, you didn't see it.
No.
Even though it was going on.
It was all over the world. Yeah.
And you didn't feel it. And you were able to live your life and go to the theater and go on a date.
Yep.
And, you know, normal kinds of things. Now you would think of the lengths you'd have to go to ignore it.
Oof. Well, you'd have to not be on social media. That'd be number one.
You'd have to really be careful what you watch on television.
Yep.
Never read a newspaper,
because
it's always front and center. Welcome back, guys. DJS on Camo X. So once a week for the remainder of the Cardinals season, we'll be talking to our good pal, Ricky Horton, former Cardinals pitcher, of course, and broadcaster. Ricky, legitimately so good to talk to you again, my friend.
Amen. I agree. It's so good to be back talking about it. But, you know, you guys have been so good to me. And I'm going to need some help. I'm going to need some help with directions on how to get to my house because I've been gone for 64 days. And I know you all are so helpful. You'll get me there.
No kidding, man. What a crazy life you have. Let's start out globally. Let's pull back 30,000 feet. Let's talk about Rick for a second. How was whatever offseason you had? How was that?
The offseason was great. You know, it's funny, Dave. I use the offseason the same way as I used to do as a player. I think about it as rejuvenation. I work out a lot. I get ready for the season like, you know, I'm going to have to get somebody out. But I think mentally, that's helpful for me. And it actually does help when the season gets going because it's a lot of travel. And again, I love it. I'm not complaining about it or the travel, spring training, all is great. But you kind of have to be ready. So I really kind of rejuvenate a lot during the off season, and it's great. We did a little traveling. We went to Scotland and Ireland and Northern Ireland, and that was great. But for the most part, just kind of getting healthy.
Very nice. Okay, so let's zoom in a little more. Before the injuries, when the Cardinals put together their roster and they brought in Sonny Gray and they brought in all these pitchers and they dealt the other guys who they did, before Newt Barr and Sonny Gray and anyone was hurt, how did you feel about the 2024 roster?
I thought they had a chance to win the division. That'd be the simplest answer for that. And I thought they'd established a team of veteran guys and young guys that would be a good mix. It would help the young guys kind of learn better, but the young guys are the good players and they bring a lot of energy. But bringing in the guys like Gray and Lance Lynn and others and Gibson, I thought would be a very interesting mix. And, you know, it's kind of worked out the way it's supposed to, except the injuries have kind of – I think they've hurt the bullpen more than anything else right now.
It's been interesting, Rick. I know last night went really well, and it was great to see Kyle Gibson in his Cardinals debut go out there and give them everything they wanted from a guy like him, which was seven innings and a chance to win the ball game, which they did. But combining last night with what you saw in L.A., where do you see the easiest opportunity for some of those tough times to turn into good? Is it just getting guys back? Is it just getting Keenan Middleton back and Sonny Gray and Lars Nootbaar and the guys?
Yeah, I think Gray certainly is one of those guys. But I think if the Cardinals would have had Keenan Middleton and Riley O'Brien, and Riley O'Brien, I think you have to put in the same category as Keenan Middleton. I think he's going to be really good. He was the best pitcher we saw in spring training. And for him to be out for 10 days or 15 days, that's kind of a bummer, too. If either of those guys had been there, they would have split with the Dodgers. And we'd be talking a whole different story instead of winning just one out of four. I think the whole idea of what the Cardinals are trying to do to get retool the bullpen, I think you could see that it's got promise, and also to bring in the veteran pitchers who did exactly what you wanted to do. Lance Lynn was tough in his start, which is why he's here, and Kyle Gibson went long in his start, which is why he's here.
I would really love to have the conundrum of having too many great outfielders and do we send Victor Scott the second back. But I have to tell you, as an emotional fan, more than an X's and O fan, I love the excitement of Victor Scott. I love the excitement of Mason Winn.
Cardinal fans are going to love Victor Scott. I mean, I got a chance to meet his family and just be around him a little bit on this road trip. And, you know, he is a level-headed guy with a lot of ability. And, you know, he acts like he belongs, and he's not arrogant about it. He's just very level-headed. And I just think Cardinal fans are going to love the excitement he brings offensively and defense. He's a really good center fielder, too. I'm not so sure the Cardinals can afford to send him back. So conundrum indeed the Cardinals are going to have when Nootbaar comes back.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you got Tommy Edman a little further down the road, too. So when you're looking ahead, like maybe a month from now, it could be Edman and Carlson. That's where it could get a little bit tighter. But for now, man, Newt coming back, I think you got to keep Victor Scott, right? I mean, you're going to have someone that's going to play center field regularly.
Well, you would and I would, and we're not making that call. And here's the main reason I want him there is not just the excitement he would bring to to the team, to the fans. He's a catalyst. He does a lot of things well. But I go back to the defense. You know, we have some outfielders. Alec Burleson, I think, is the best hitter on the Cardinals. Now, a lot of people aren't going to agree with me on that. I think he's the best pure hitter that the Cardinals have. So where do you play him? You play him in left field. You play Jordan Walker in right field. Your center fielder better be pretty good.
Yeah.
You better cover a lot of ground because those guys are more hitters than they are defenders. And so Victor Scott brings you that in a way no one else can.
So, Rick, you've seen a lot of opening days, opening day day after tomorrow. Talk about it from your perspective as a player and talk about it from your perspective up in the booth watching it happen.
I think I've told you guys this before. Daryl Porter told me my first opening day in St. Louis. He walked over to me and he showed me goosebumps on his arm. And he said, I've been at a lot of these, and it doesn't stop getting like this, and you will always feel goosebumps on opening day. And he was right. I mean, honestly, it's a rebirth. It's a new year. It's a celebration. It's a party. It's a lot of energy. It feels like playoff baseball in a lot of ways on opening day. It's just the pageantry of it. And, you know, it's going to be the Cardinals really do it well. We were at the Dodgers opening day. It was good. And, you know, having been a Dodger, it was good, but the Cardinals do it as better than anybody in my mind. And I think even as a broadcaster, I feel the same way. I get the goosebumps when the Hall of Famers are out there. It's just really some special moments to watch for.
And, you know, when you look at it from a player's perspective, Rick, how are those days? I mean, I know they're exciting, and I know that, you know, everybody's got the goosebumps and they're fired up to be in front of the hometown for the first time. What about routine? I mean, you know, guys are very routine-oriented. How much do you have to adapt and be aware of that?
Well, I think what you have to do is really compartmentalize, and I think players are pretty good at that. And travel is always the thing that messes up your routine.
Yeah.
And Cardinals have been in a lot of different time zones, and you realize that, okay, that's one of those things that happens. And even the opening day that they had in L.A., that wasn't the same as what you normally do. So what you do is you take in the cool nature of what's going on, and then you kind of shut it down, and you just go towards what you need to do to prepare, and you adapt at that point. And then, honestly, I think you feel it later. I always felt that way at big moments. It's like I notice it when it's going on, but I don't have time to feel it. I have to do my thing. I'll feel it later.
Interesting.
Rick, you spend a lot of time with the guys, and it's very early on. They haven't really established their clubhouse yet. They haven't really established all their little idiosyncrasies and the vibes. But so far, how does it feel?
Yeah, I might even, you know, I hate to disagree with you, Dave, because, you know, you're the best, and I agree with you 100% of the time, but I'm going to say I think it has been established. And it's odd. Spring training is so long that I think, you know, and I've seen the establishment of what the plan was, which was to get veteran guys teaching young guys feeling the space to fail and feeling the ability to just let their ability go without kind of looking over their shoulders. And I think the clubhouse is really good. Being around them in spring training, and again, that's 30 days or plus of spring training, so I think we've had time to see it kind of come together. There was no World Baseball Classic to interrupt that. Mm-hmm. And I actually would say that the clubhouse is already good. Now, is the talent good enough to win? That is yet to be seen, but at least in terms of what the clubhouse is like, I like it.
That is our pal, Ricky Horton. Rick, you're the best. Look forward to seeing you soon, my friend.
All right, guys.